International Diplomatic Student Association is Hungary-based student organization for university students interested in political science, multilateral treaties, and intergovernmental relations. IDSA podcast aims to educate its listeners on career opportunities to university students in Hungary, opening their minds to pressing social and geopolitical issues. The podcast is recorded with the support of EPR Radio.
Welcome everyone to the fourth episode of the IDSA podcast. Let me introduce ourselves briefly. My name is Dóra Tóth and I'm a second year student at IBS. My co-interviewer is Réka Bogár, who is a third year student at Corvinus University.
Hi everyone.
We are both members of the professional team of IDSA. Today we are gonna have a real special guest, Nicolette Garai, who works as a researcher and a mentor at the Institute of Foreign Affairs and Trade. In this episode, we will discuss the successful career path of Nicolette, and you will also take a glimpse of the main research areas of her work and their challenges. So welcome, Nicolette, to our podcast. We are delighted that you accepted our invitation.
Hi, thank you very much for your invitation.
Let's get started with the questions. Nicolette, you have been working for the Institute of Foreign Affairs and Trade for 5 years as a researcher and program coordinator. Could you please tell us about this and your role there?
Wow, it's already been 5 years. It's a really long time. We are actually the leading foreign policy think tank in Hungary. We used to be a background institution of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, but since a couple of years, we work under a separate legal entity, but we still do foreign policy research. Actually, our aim is twofold. On one hand, we would like to inform the public about current affairs, which are currently developing in the international politics and in European politics and in Hungary as well. We would like to contribute to the public discourse and make our work visible. On the other hand, we are helping different government institutions and ministries, and we support decision-making by providing them analysis, reports, and other kinds of materials. So it's a very complex job that we do there. Most of the people who work there, we are research fellows and analysts who have a foreign policy or economics background. We are not that big organization, actually, but we spend most of our time writing analysis, reports, but our job is very complex, actually, because we attend different kinds of public events. That's because we have to inform the public about current undertakings. So we usually go to workshops, to conferences. We discuss important issues in connection with foreign policy in different panels, for example. And also most of us teaches at different universities here in Hungary or abroad. We also do other materials because we realize that in order to reach a wider public, which ranges from university students to the professionals as well, we decided to have our own podcast, which comes out in a weekly basis, more or less. And we have other formats, which is more easy to digest, like smaller reports and so on and so forth. So we do a lot of different things, which sometimes can be very exhausting, but this is our goal, to support decision-making, which is not always so easy, and it is not that good feeling if your recommendations are not welcomed, but that's how it works.
Thank you, Nicolette. It's great to see that you have such a colorful job, which gives you challenges every other day. So let's jump to the next question. If you are correct, you are also a mentor of the research internship program at the Institute of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Since our listeners are mainly young students interested in international relations, we believe that this program is something worth discussing in this podcast. To whom and why would you recommend this particular program?
Okay, that is a really good question because our internship program is a fundamental part of what we do at the Institute. I used to be an intern as well, so my career at the Institute started as a very basic regular intern. However, since then, well, the internship program went under a lot of developments, partly because a couple of researchers who work there nowadays used to be also interns, so we could give a good feedback how to develop this program. Everyone can apply, actually, from different backgrounds as well, so you don't have to be a student of international relations or political sciences or economics to be an IFAT intern. I really like to tell those stories to people that, for example, we had interns who studied physics or mathematics, and they stayed there to work with us on different projects because their expertise were very much needed. And still, I have an ongoing project in which one of the interns with a physics background is a fundamental part, and actually he is paid for doing that job, so everyone can join. This internship is designed to develop basically analytical skills and analytical thinking. So if you don't want to be a researcher, I still recommend to do this program because it is very complex. There is a training program in every week where you can learn how to think analytically, how to do academic writing, how to do your research design, how to develop methodologically. So you can learn different kinds of methodologies with us. And also we organize field trips to different kinds of institutions, ministries, or international organizations, NGOs. So I think it's a really interesting mixture of professional academic stuff. But on the other hand, it is also very practical because you can meet a lot of interesting people and professionals who work in this field. And the third thing is that you have to write your own policy brief at the end of the internship. And to do that, you will be assigned to a mentor who will supervise your work and help you, guide you throughout your journey at the Institute. I was very lucky because I had a very good mentor, Máté Szalai, who is a great researcher, and together we published a lot of things even when I was an intern. So that's the way how I'd like to go with my own interns as well, and I think that it is a great opportunity for everyone.
Thank you, and I also have two practical questions in connection with this. The first one is that how can we apply? And the second one that is this particularly for students or people who already graduated could participate in this program?
Well, we organize this internship program 2 times a year. This is according to the university semesters. So the next time you can apply to this internship is next September. So the autumn program begins in September or early October. So you have to apply for that in August or the beginning of September. And then you spend there 5 or 6 months, actually. We have the spring semester, which started just a couple of weeks ago. So it is already done. But next September, we are happy to welcome everyone again. Basically, everyone can apply, but mostly we provide this internship to BA, MA, and PhD students. We are very well know that BA and MA students can learn much more than, for example, PhD students, but we always check individually everyone's application, so it always depends on the personal interest of the interns as well, and on the availability of the mentors, of course. But if someone does research in a very interesting area, which is current, which is a hot topic, or which is not very much discussed in Hungarian foreign policy discourse, then we are more than happy to welcome those people.
Thank you, and it was really interesting what you mentioned, that this internship is also useful for people who doesn't necessarily would like to be a researcher in their future. So my next question is connected to that, because people usually say that studying international relations could be a solid ground for multiple career paths. Why did you choose to become a researcher in the first place?
I didn't really choose to be a researcher, to be honest. So when I was younger, I never thought that I would end up as a researcher. Well, it just happened somehow. Well, I have to be honest here in this podcast because I would like to. So my story was that when I started university, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I didn't want to become a lawyer. I didn't want to become an economist or a doctor. So I was like, okay, I choose international relations. It's murky enough. I don't really know what that is, but sounds very good. So I started to study international relations. And after that, at the beginning of my studies, I was very much surprised that most of my classmates, they already know what they want to do with their life. Most of them wanted to be diplomats or work for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade or an international organization like the UN or the EU. But I didn't really know. And actually, when I joined IDSA, that was the first step when I realized that, okay, I might actually be interested in international relations, and IDSA helped me to get my focus. And after that, I started a lot of internships and different kinds of volunteering works. And somehow, after a couple of years, with not that much working experience, I ended up at IFAT as an intern. So that's how everything started. And it turned out that I liked it really much, and I still like it very much. I hope that I can do it for a very long time.
We are very happy that you've mentioned IDSA help you through this career path. And my second question is about your research. So you have been focusing on the Visegrad Group and mainly the politics of Poland and Czech Republic. What do you consider to be the most important challenges that the Visegrad Group faces with?
That's a hard question, actually, because the V4 faces many challenges. And we always focus on challenges, but not on opportunities and things that they are doing great. Dealing with Central Europe as such and dealing with the V4 and with the domestic politics of those countries gives me sometimes a very hard time, especially because those are very much politicized questions nowadays in Hungary. So you have to be very prepared all the time to not to say things that can jeopardize your career, for example. However, as researchers at the Institute, we are always very much keen on being pragmatic and being professionally good. So when it comes to the Visegrad 4, I really believe that it is really hard for ordinary people and also for researchers as well to see beyond what that cooperation is about. So we can always read or hear in the media that, okay, the Visegrad 4 is not cohesive or they don't work together very well because they don't really vote all the time together. Which is certainly true. Nowadays, we can hear that, for example, most of the media outlets try to say that, okay, because the V4 countries didn't oppose the multi-annual financial framework on the same way, that this means that the Visegrad 4 will end. I always try to say to my students at the university and to my interns as well that we have to think in processes and look after what decision was made. And in this regard, if we check the whole history of the Visegrad cooperation, we can see that there were always times when the cooperation didn't go so well, and there were times when it just flourished. And the reason behind is that the V4 is a very flexible cooperation, which means that they don't have institution like a parliament or a secretariat or a commission or something like that. It is purely intergovernmental. And that means that it is very flexible. So if they don't agree in certain issue, then they don't cooperate. This is an advantage, but this can be a disadvantage in the same time. I think to understand this and to convey how they actually work, is the biggest challenge for the V4, because it's not really a regular institutionalized cooperation, and it's hard to get what that it is about. And another challenge from this is that the V4 cooperation goes on different levels. So what we see in our everyday life, it is the prime minister's level and the head of state level, for example, they discuss sensitive political issues. And that's what we hear from the media every day. If there is an agreement, then they agree. If there's no agreement, then they just don't agree. However, there are other levels which are not interested for the wider public, because they are very specific issues in which they cooperate, for example, in interparliamentary commissions about agricultural things, for example. Let's face it, it's not that interesting, so we won't hear about that anything in the media, but it's still ongoing. And another thing is that the International Visegrad Fund was established a couple of years ago, which finances very important issues, like, for example, student exchanges and different kinds of projects. So this is a cultural and educational aspect of the V4 countries. So I think those are challenges to convey how they actually work. And of course, the reputation is always a challenge. I would say that in the last 6-7 years, if we read the presidency programs of the Visegrad Cooperation, it was always very well stated that they want to enhance their visibility in the European Union. Well, we can have a debate about that, whether it was a success or not, but in that regard, it was success that they wanted to achieve more visibility, and they get it. So that's about the V4 and about their policies. The other challenge for them is that even though they like to say and we like to think that those four countries are very similar, they have major differences. For example, in their security perceptions, their threat perceptions. Obviously, because of the geopolitical closeness to Russia, Poland will always have a different understanding on Russian relationships than Hungary or the Czech Republic or Slovakia. So in these hardcore issues, when it comes to security and main foreign policy decisions, they tend to disagree, which some say that it's a bad thing, but I would say that, well, it's just a thing and they don't cooperate in certain aspects. They find another aspect in which they cooperate.
Thank you for the detailed answer. And about Central Europe, so what do you think? What are the main political developments of Central Europe?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Well, it depends from which aspect we would like to see this question. I would say that one of the most interesting developments recently started after that those countries joined the European Union. So before that, we had our traditional cleavage lines. I mean those lines which divided the citizens based on different political issues. So before joining the European Union, we could be sure that we are conservatives, we are liberals, we are Christian Democrats, we are social democrats, or we vote for that party because they are on the left side of the political spectrum or the right side. That was a well-established system. But after we joined the European Union, new cleavage lines were added to the original ones, which made politics more messy. I call these transnational cleavage lines because one of the main aspects was actually attitudes towards the European Union as such, whether you are pro-EU person, whether you prefer less integration, or you prefer what is actually here. So those are very different mentalities and attitudes. Plus, we have other ones as well, like for example, attitudes towards international migration, attitudes towards globalization. I mean, you can be for the globalization, or you can be rather nationalistic or protectionist or something like that. And also, when it comes to globalization, international trade is also such an issue. And those attitudes now are mixed a bit, and those actually, in my opinion, contributed to a greater competition for parties. Political parties had to adapt themselves to these new realities, and they had to have new programs and new ideas, and they absorbed those salient issues, which became more important in the recent years. So the competition was very big and is still very big. On the other hand, we can see that, which is a very alarming tendency, I would say, that societies are more and more polarized. And that has something to do with the nature of politics, what we're experiencing nowadays. We can call it populism, we can call it a lot of different names, but maybe the nature of the politics changed as well because we have new actors and we cannot disregard them. We have the public opinion, we have the media outlets, we have the social media. These are new factors which just increase the competition and the polarization, in my opinion. And to talk about something not so political, I think that another development which is very much on the table at the moment is the demographics of this region. Because just like Western European countries, Central European countries are aging as well. We face an aging population, and we can have different kinds of problems from that. But the interesting thing is that Central European countries handle that situation on a very different way. So I have recently conducted a research on the demographics of Central Europe, and it was very interesting to see to find out that, for example, in the Czech Republic and in Slovakia, the population is very slowly growing, while in Hungary, the population is decreasing. And in Poland, it's sometimes decreasing, sometimes it's increasing. And one of the main factors behind that is actually migration. And I'm not talking about asylum seekers and so on, but international migration, regular migration, people come to work to these countries and then they stay and then they find their life in there. So that's very interesting that even though those countries are very similar, they are not that similar in a lot of aspects.
Could the pandemic result in a new trade and foreign affairs opportunities for these regions and then negative or positive ones?
You are asking very hard questions, actually. Well, at the Institute, we are discussing this question a lot with the colleagues and with colleagues from abroad. I would say that until the pandemic is ongoing, we couldn't really something that will be true definitely. So we can say that there are certain issues and tendencies that we believe that they are probable to happen in a way, but it's still very early to, I think, to this question. In policy perspective, I have conducted a couple of researches and analysis in connection with how Central European countries' relation with the big powers. So, for example, relations with the US or China or Russia or the European Union, say that at the beginning there was not much change. So, obviously, again, say something all of the V4 countries or all of the Central European countries, sovereign states, and they act usually in these very important foreign policy questions in accordance. One thing that is very interesting to highlight, I think, is that when it comes to the mask diplomacy and vaccine diplomacy, so we hear a lot of things about why Hungary or Slovakia purchased vaccines from Russia. Well, this is obviously a foreign policy decision as well. And for me, it's very interesting that the European Commission, which was just 1 year ago, and which is headed by Ursula von der Leyen, strategy was and their program was to to have a geopolitical commission. So they wanted to strengthen the geopolitical power, the foreign policy power of the European Union. And obviously, a member state doesn't follow the joint policy or the guidance, then that decreases the chances of this policy to come true or to become apparent to all of the actors of the international politics. So this is something that we can consider when it comes to those vaccine diplomacy. And on the other hand, it depends on the level of trust. So those countries, like, for example, Hungary, who governmental level have more trust towards Russia or China, they will then purchase from their vaccines. However, if you don't have such a good relations, governmental relations with those countries, or you follow the EU guidance, then you won't. So it's a hard domestic politic issue as well, but a foreign policy issue as well. And we cannot really see these developments will affect their foreign policy opportunities yet. We can see that that this is an ongoing process. We are always there once a phenomena is already done. I think that after the pandemic ends, we will be able to analyze the situation in a more concrete way. And from an economic perspective, actually, there are a lot of issue that because of the pandemic, global supply chains will divide somehow. And a lot of people expect that Central Europe could be in the situation that great companies or big companies will pay their factories, for example, in here. But I'm a bit pessimist in this regard, together with the colleagues, about that. And actually, we feel that in case of foreign policy issues, it's not a finite phenomenon, and it's not a finite process yet. So we will know more once the whole pandemic ends. But relocating your supply chains, it's not that easy. And that's something that gradually can be done. So actually sure whether it will be done or not.
So, Nikki, I also would like to thank you that you shared your view in connection with the V4, Central Europe and the pandemic. What I really found interesting is that you emphasize the intergovernmental nature of the V4, and we are really interested in what the Hungarian presidency will bring for the V4 from the 1st of July. So after discussing these important questions, let's turn back a little bit to your career. My question is that was there a particular moment or a research project in your career that you are the most proud of?
Well, actually, not really. I mean, I believe that every little thing has an important effect on my career that I made. So I always say that it's not big moments in people's life which define your career or your success, but the small ones, and you have to be able to find something small in every day. So I remember, for example, when I started my internship at IFAD, that was great, some kind of a big moment relatively. And then I remember when one of my first policy papers got published, that was also something. I remembered when I was first invited to a panel discussion or when I was first invited to a radio interview. So those, relatively small things for me, the most important things. And also research projects, I have to be honest here. So that when it comes to research projects, it's a really hard task and really hard job just to do the research, but to have the funding for it. So not enough to be smart, for example, to be able to create the circumstances for your research project that you would like to do. That's one of the hardest things of being a researcher. You always for money, you always have to ask for money from different organizations and grants and so on and so forth. So I was very happy when I wrote my first research proposal and project proposal and it got funding.
Thank you so much. Then let's get back to the topic of IDSA. So you were also a member of IDSA and you later became a president. How do you feel? It is worth being a member of IDSA? And what way did IDSA help you through your career?
Wow. I remember that I first got here, Corvinus, I was kind of confused because I am originally from a very small town from south of Hungary. And when I started Corvinus, it was very intimidating that most of the people knew already what they wanted to do. And, well, I didn't really know what I wanted to do at that time until I joined IDSA because say that that was the first thing in my career that encouraged me to stay here in this field and to stay in this community. So I remember that in 2013 was the first year when they started to operate and I was among the first newbies there. And I really liked that everyone was very open, everyone was really kind and they were interested in the same things like me. And that gave me a huge confidence boost, actually. So if I wouldn't join, I don't know what I would be today. Most likely not a researcher, but something else. But a good community there. We helped each other a lot, and we worked a lot, actually, together. So started out everything with MUN clubs, like Model United Nations and debating. And the debating club. And actually we met every week with a new topic and we just debated among ourselves about the most interesting issues. And that helped me a lot because I became interested in a lot of topics which were very current. But on the other hand, IDSA was the place where I learned English the most. So I think it was a very good experience to perfect my skills and not just the academic ones and in knowledge, but in other soft skills as well, like how to debate, how to talk in front of a crowd, or how to argue in English, for example, and also how to work together with other people. So I'm really happy that I could be part of IDSA, and I think that was a defining moment. If just going back to your previous question, maybe that was the most defining point in my career. And also, after a couple of years there, I wanted to actually be more part of the organization, apply to the presidency as well, and somehow I did it. So there were a lot of people who actually helped me. And, you know, the best thing is that I still have friends from IDSA today. And it's such a good feeling that, you know, when I organize an event or something at the institute, I would like to call someone from a ministry or from another institution. And I see the names that, oh my God, I know them from IDSA. And it's just a good feeling that I know that they think the same way I think about things in connection with the world. We share the same values because we have the common roots from this organization, which we really consider as a family. So it's just a very good feeling that IDSA is still working and that now I can give today an interview how IDSA helped me through my careers. So I think joining IDSA is a really good idea. And even if you don't want to be involved in foreign policy or international relations, you still can have important experiences. I have friends who work now in different fields, but IDSA was actually good for them because they could learn the basics of teamwork. You tell someone else when you screw up or maybe others screw up. So altogether is a very good social experience and an academic experience as well.
Thank you. We still think of IDSA as a second family, and what you said is also really true, and we are really glad that we are an international organization because we only communicate in English, and that really helps a lot in our career. So after you studied international relations as a bachelor degree, you went for master's, and now you are currently a PhD student at Corvinus University. Last semester, we could also learn from you in the framework of the Theorizing Hungarian Foreign Policy course. What motivates you in your PhD program? Is teaching at a university level something that you enjoy?
Okay, about my motivations. Sometimes I feel in the think tank world that I'm not that academic and I'm in need for more. And that's basically the main reason why I applied to the PhD. I can do the PhD actually as part of my job as well, because I'm doing research on the same issues, on the same topics, actually small state foreign policy behavior, and I'm focusing on Central Europe. Teaching. So far, I like it very much. I just like to be like a teacher, which I wanted to have when I was my BA and my MA. And I think that students are doing very well in courses and classes if you give them the opportunity to speak up for themselves and to speak their mind. I always try discussions and hear their opinions about issues, because I always get a lot of ideas from them for my own work. So far, I'm not so experienced in teaching. I have several courses at different colleges, for example. I hope that I will be able to teach complete courses at the Corvinus University.
So the last question in this podcast would be the following. What would be your advice for young university students? What does it take to be a successful researcher?
Well, it depends what you define as successful. In my opinion, what is success for me? A successful researcher if your work is recognized academically by other scholars, by other professionals, and you can have a discussion with them. That's very important. However, if you would like to be an example for your work, you have to be able to communicate your research to the average people. And I think this is the hardest part, because you are always consulting with other colleagues, with other professionals, and sometimes you just cannot translate everything to a normal human language. So people don't understand what you talk about, and people don't understand what your research is about. And if that's the case, then you are a bad researcher, because you are not able to tell the people what's going on. So what's the point doing research if you cannot help other people to understand the phenomenon or a tendency or anything? So I think that the combination of these two things, being professionally adequate and recognized, and being able to tell people on an easy way what you are doing and why it is important, also very hard but very important. So I learned that in IFAT, that at the beginning I was really struggling with the plain language. So how can I convey my findings of the research to other people? So this is a very very hard task, especially for young researchers who would like to show that you are knowledgeable, that you are you know everything about your field. This is especially hard for them, I think.
Thank you, Nikki, for accepting our invitation. And we wish you all the best for your future career as well. We are sure that this podcast has been really useful for our listeners since we touched many up-to-date topics. Thank you for listening. See you 2 weeks later with our last edition. My name is Reka Bogar, and my co-interviewer was Dora Toth, and our podcast guest was Nicolette Gorey.
Thank you very much for having me here.
International Diplomatic Student Association is Hungary-based student organization for university students interested in political science, multilateral treaties, and intergovernmental relations. IDSA podcast aims to educate its listeners on career opportunities to university students in Hungary, opening their minds to pressing social and geopolitical issues. The podcast is recorded with the support of EPR Radio.